I'll just start with a reminder that your next tutorial is going to be this afternoon. The topic is going to be a little bit of a departure from the things we've been looking at, because as we begin our discussion of non-thermal dark matter, we're going to need a bunch of results from quantum field theory that at least I've been told you have not seen before. So this is going to be sort of a guided derivation and calculation of some quantities in non-perturbative field theory. Where my descriptions are confusing, Tibor will be there to enlighten you all. So hopefully that will be useful preparation. The things that are still unclear we'll go over in lecture when we hit those topics. Okay, but hopefully this will lay some of the groundwork. Before we do the conclusion to the story about dark matter colliders, I want to see whether there are any questions coming out of the tutorial at the end of last week, or any things that you thought of since we were last here together. Okay, well, if something comes to mind, just you can feel free to interrupt. So where we left off was we had derived the way that you can go from the matrix element level to computing the rate of dark matter production from protons. And we saw that what we needed to have was dark matter production in association with an additional parton. And this gives you a monojet signature. And then what you look for is, if this is beam one and beam two, you look for dark matter going off in one direction and the jet going off in the other, in the transverse plane. And this, we called this missing transverse energy, or just missing energy. So in order to discuss the results, we also needed to talk about what standard model processes could fake this. And what we found was that a process that could fake it was the production of a Z boson. Because Z bosons can decay into two neutrinos, which also gives missing energy. So you can have, for instance, a Z boson plus a jet. And this also gives you something that looks exactly like this, except instead of chi and chi bar, you go to nu and nu bar. Now, the sensitivity of our dark matter search is going to depend very much on how well we can estimate this contribution. The reason being that we don't actually see the particles going off. And so if this looks identical to this, then there's not really a whole lot of handles that we can have. Whereas if we can understand how many of these background events we should have, then we can say, look for a small excess over that. And so the way that we do a background estimate is through something called the data-driven approach. And it's to use things that are not the signal, but that we can very easily relate to the signal that we can look for at the experiment. So I just run the experiment and I look for what we call our control process. And I say, okay, how often did the control process happen? And then if it's well understood theoretically how to map the rate for the control process for the rate into the background for the signal, then I can immediately get a good estimate for how much this should happen. And it turns out that for this Z in association with a quark, there's a very good control process. And that control process is this. It's still Q Z production. So it's literally the same Feynman diagram from the perspective of the strong interactions. But instead of decaying into muons, I'm going to decay into charged leptons. Now, my dark matter signal definitely is never going to contribute to this, because dark matter does not give me missing energy. It doesn't give me charged stuff. But we know that neutrinos and charged leptons are part of an SU2 doublet. And so we know exactly how to take the rate for L plus L minus production and map it into a nu bar production, because it's literally the same thing. Of course, the charged leptons have masses, but the masses of, say, the muon is about 100 MeV. Electron is about 0.5 MeV. Since we're colliding things at energies a few hundred GeV, from the perspective of the collider, these are basically the same thing. Yes, Tibor.
Also, could we not adjust for that mass by kind of?
You could, but I mean, that's not the dominant contribution, so you don't even need to go there. Yeah. So this is just a statement of the fact that at high energies, we don't see a broken SU2. We kind of see a restored SU2. And so because this and this are related by SU2, we can exactly calculate the relationship between these. And so it means that we don't have to be very good at estimating the strong interaction part, because that's very, very difficult. All we have to do is measure this and then map it onto this, and then this tells us what our background is. Now, this works to getting, so we can get the uncertainty on the mapping down to maybe 5%. But this does not work indefinitely, because, of course, you have to ask, well, do we ever miss any charged leptons? You have to correct for that, and you have to correct for the response of the detector and all of these kinds of things. So this works pretty well, but it's not, at a certain point, this is going to stall, and we're going to collect much more data, and if my signal never exceeds 5% of the data, then I'm never going to be able to say anything about it. Okay, so at some point, these searches will kind of plateau. Okay, so given that this is the estimate, I showed this picture yesterday, or at the end of the last lecture, but what we had was a plot that was like missing energy and number of events. And the background looked, you know, some falling distribution, and the signal was some other distribution. You can try and look for this tail. So now the most model-independent thing that we can think about doing is that we do the same thing we did for direct detection, which is we write down various operators that couple dark matter to quarks. So we can write down things like this, or this, and what we can do is we can then compute a rate from this and say, I'm going to put a limit on lambda. Now, at the LHC, we don't have to worry about these velocity suppressions that we were worrying about before. Because remember, whether it was direct detection or indirect detection, we were detecting dark matter in the halo, which was very, very slow. However, when you produce things at the LHC, the typical energy is very high. And so dark matter has sort of an order one velocity. So what we'll see is that different Lorentz structures don't actually have very different constraints up to the way that they're defined. Okay, so the current limits, okay, are in the range of, so if we have vector coupling, lambda is bigger than about 900 GeV for an axial vector. Also about 900 GeV. This is what I mean by it doesn't really matter what the Lorentz structure is. For the scalar, it's actually substantially worse. The reason is that for a scalar, they usually take the assumption that this operator is proportional to mass. Okay, so they make the assumption that what's really going on is that you have n quark over lambda cube, chi bar chi, Q bar Q. And the reason for this is that the only scalar in the standard model, the Higgs boson, couples this way. And so this is often how new physics scalars couple. And so this weak coupling or weak bound more comes from the fact that this scalar mostly couples to the B quark, which we don't really have in the proton. If you look at the gluon operator, it's a little bit weaker, but not substantially. It's like 350 GeV. So the LHC is definitely putting constraints on this. And what they find is that nominally the thermal relic is excluded sort of in the 20 to 80 GeV range for the vector and axial vector. Okay, So this is sort of the simplest thing that you can do. But there should be something that is a little bit troubling about this, which is namely that the assumption for deriving this operator was that this is secretly some g squared over m g to the fourth over m phi to the fourth, where m phi is the mediator. We were assuming that the mediator mass was much, much bigger than the energy. But if we look at the fact that we're colliding things at a few hundred GeV, and our bounds are also at a few hundred GeV, you can question the validity of this approach. The reason being that what's secretly here is some propagator and this propagator is 1 over m phi squared minus energy squared. Well, it's really the minus of this. And so as the energy gets closer to m phi, this approximation gets worse and worse. And so this was sort of the popular approach for the LHC experiments up to about this year. But finally, theorists have been able to convince the experimentalists that this is maybe not actually a very good way of talking about the limits, just because you can constrain this operator, but this operator is not meaningful, because this operator doesn't actually represent any real theory. Right? That this operator is only valid in this limit, and this limit is violated for a substantial fraction of events. And you can see this in the fact that that in the most, let's call it stringent selections, the experiments require the missing energy to be bigger than about 700 GeV. So the kinematics of this event are clearly above the cutoff associated with these theories. Okay. So this breaks down completely. And so if you start including the mediator into your theory, then the constraints change a lot. Okay, so they've now taken to providing these kinds of plots where you give the mass of the mediator, which we're calling phi, so I'll just write phi. Then you can put the constraint on m over the couplings. And what you see is that at high mediator mass, you recover the effective field theory line, which is what you expect. But then it sort of follows some funny trajectory. And the contours here are contours of constant coupling. So this is root g chi, gq, 0.2, 1, 2, etc. This is the mass of the mediator over the square root of the couplings. Yes. So the reason why it's called that is because 1 over lambda squared, I was writing things in terms of cross section. 1 over lambda squared is m phi squared over g squared. Yeah. So you can just take the square root of that. So what this is telling you is that there isn't just a bound on a particular value of lambda, but actually the constraints can get stronger on the coupling or they can get weaker on the coupling. And so what we find is that for small mediator mass, constraint gets very weak. Relative to the bound on lambda. And the reason for that is just that this Lagrangian, if I compute the rate, it grows with energy. But if I have a small mediator mass, it grows with energy and then falls off with energy. So really at the LHC, you should not think about producing two dark matter in a monojet, but you should think about producing the mediator and a monojet, and then this subsequently decays to dark matter. And it's important to consider the scenario where the mediator is actually in the theory and you're producing it on shell. And of course, this also means that if this mediator couples to dark matter and it couples to standard model quarks, you can also have the mediator decaying into quarks. So you can just do direct mediator searches. So this looks like a new force that interacts with quarks, essentially. So the sort of current status of dark matter searches at colliders is that there's sort of this trade-off between a very model-independent approach, which is nice from the perspective of you can sort of ignore various details of the theory. And the price you pay is that the theory is not really very consistent, and so it's hard to know how to interpret those results. What you really want to do is include the mediator, but now all of a sudden you worry that, well, do I have to consider all kinds of combinations of coupling? Because now if I independently vary GQ and G chi, I change the branching fraction into dark matter versus quarks, and my constraints are dependent on those individual couplings, and suddenly your parameter space kind of blows up. So sort of most research in this area is going towards how do I balance these needs. Yeah, so
how much does change if you consider a scalar or a vector?
Yeah, so in terms of rate, usually if I take a literally identical couplings, they're just of order like factor of two or so. A lot of that comes from the fact that a vector has more polarizations that you sum over. So there aren't huge differences between a vector and a scalar, but it does change, let's put it this way. A scalar couples a left and a right-handed fermion, and a vector couples two of the same sign. And so being consistent with all of your other electroweak precision constraints and everything is very different for them. So so it gets tricky. But in terms of the LHC, you usually don't really care that much which one is a vector, which is a scalar. Okay, so this is sort of wraps up our discussion of dark matter at colliders. The one thing that I want to mention is that, of course, the LHC is not the only collider that we have. There are plans for future colliders. And when I say plans, I really mean hopes more. So some numbers that are bandied around are Hadron Collider at 100 TeV. Okay, that would be really amazing, but it's probably going to cost a lot of money, so that's an open question. Or a Higgs factory, which would be an E plus E minus collider with an energy that's about 250 GeV. The Higgs factory is great because it'll produce a lot of Higgs bosons, but the energy is not very high. So this is probably not the best machine for discovering things that are very heavy, but maybe doing precision measurements of things that are very light. And then finally, things that are often overlooked are low energy colliders. And these are often referred to as intensity frontier, which was sort of invented because people were feeling inadequate because they're saying, well, the LHC is colliding things at 13 TeV and we're colliding things at 10 GeV. Why is this important? The reason why this is important is that you can produce a heck of a lot more particles at 10 GeV than you can at 13 TeV. And so if you can collide 1,000 times more collisions here, you can accumulate a lot of data and sort of infer the existence of things that way. And this turns out to be the best probe of light mediators and light dark matter. So for instance, two faculty here, Philip Schuster and Natalia Toro, propose an experiment that's, two experiments. One is called APEX, the A prime experiment. The other is the heavy photon surge. And these operate at energies in the GeV range. But they produce a ton of data, and so they look for mediators that are very light and very weakly coupled. And what's interesting about these experiments is that they can often piggyback off of other things that are going on. So for instance, a lot of nuclear physics experiments or experiments that are trying to produce medical isotopes are colliding things at low energies. So you can just kind of stick a detector somewhere nearby and see if you see any evidence for dark matter or dark forces that are involved at these energy scales. Okay. So this, particularly at PI, is really a hot topic. You know, there are lots of directions that you can go for these collider probes of dark matter. Okay, so are there any other questions about sort of the conclusion to this section? Okay. Pardon me?
How do you know the mass?
You don't. And so that's another parameter. So these theories have sort of a multiplicity of parameters, whereas here there was just lambda and m chi. So yeah. In this picture, you have this cutoff scale and you have m chi. Here you have m chi, m phi, g chi, gq, g lepton, g everything else. Okay. So the constraints really depend on what else it's coupling to. And that's why it's harder to make a universal statement of we've excluded a thermal relic or something like that, because it really depends on exactly all of these properties. And as you can expect, the more parameters you add, the more fuzzy everything gets, and the more you can find hiding places. Okay. So we're now going to change gears, and we're going to consider a class of theories that are known as non-thermal dark matter scenarios. And if we go back and think about what motivated the WIMP picture, we had this process of thermal freeze out, bar. So we found that this was, you know, 3 and 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second, or 6, depending on whether it's Dirac or Majorana. And this told us that we had large couplings. And everything that we've done so far for experimental tests has been assuming that the scenario is true and working through the implications. And that's very important, and that's been historically what most people have done when looking at dark matter. But if we're very honest, then we have to admit that the assumption of order one couplings depends a lot on this scenario. And in particular, if dark matter is not produced through thermal freeze out, then we completely lose all of our motivation. And in fact, we would expect all of the experiments I've been talking about to not see anything. And so this is sort of perhaps a depressing prospect for people who are working on dark matter experiments. But part of the reason why people are beginning to question this framework, or at least the dominance of this framework, is that none of the experiments have seen any evidence for dark matter. And not only that, none of the experiments have even seen any evidence for anything other than dark matter that's new. So for instance, if we had this picture of a Z2 even and Z2 odd sectors, you maybe expect there to be all kinds of other particles. And the LHC can put quite stringent constraints on those other particles. So in your tutorial, you looked at if you have T-channel mediators or new SU3 charge things in the theory, there are very stringent constraints on that as well. And so if we're not seeing anything new at the weak scale, then maybe our assumption that dark matter is sitting at the weak scale is not a very good one. So what we're going to do is relax some of the assumptions. And in particular, we're going to ask the question, what if dark matter was never in thermal equilibrium? So this has sort of been the basic underpinning. And if dark matter does have order one couplings with the standard model, it definitely was in thermal equilibrium, and you get this thermal freeze-out scenario. But if it wasn't in thermal equilibrium, then you won't get thermal freeze-out because you don't have any evolution of a thermal dark matter abundance. So if it was not in thermal equilibrium, what changes? What we find is that dark matter can become sensitive to initial conditions, for lack of a better word. Okay, so if dark matter is in equilibrium, the fact that it enters equilibrium sort of wipes out any memory of what the dark matter was doing before that. But if it's never in equilibrium, then we have to specify its evolution over the whole thermal history, and it's going to be very sensitive to what's going on potentially at very early times. So this is one reason why it's challenging to make very general statements about non-thermal dark matter, because depending on what I was doing in the early universe, I can get very different effects. The other thing that's true is that you have small couplings, very small couplings. And so experimental detection suddenly becomes much harder, or basically impossible, through many of the channels we've been discussing. And so if we want this to be the true story of dark matter, we have to think of some new ways that we can maybe test them. And once again, these are going to be more model dependent than they would be otherwise. I didn't mean to send it all the way up, but okay. So there are going to be two specific mechanisms that we'll look at. And admittedly, these are somewhat arbitrary, okay. But part of that is that there is this proliferation of models, and so we need to restrict ourselves to some subset. And the two that we will consider cover a lot of the conceptual bases that you need. And so if you can understand these, then it's not too big of a jump to consider the other ones. So these are a process called thermal freeze-in, which is sort of the opposite of thermal freeze-out in a way that I will specify. And the second is misalignment production of scalar dark matter. And this, so these sort of span the range of things that look a lot like the thermal scenarios we've been considering, except for the fact that dark matter never quite comes into equilibrium. This one is going to be an extremely non-thermal scenario in that we can't really use any of the tools that we've been developing. But it's a very interesting scenario. If for those of you who are studying cosmology, you'll find that the dynamics of this are somewhat similar to what you might see for inflation. And this is also motivated by some beyond the standard model extensions. So this is something that a lot of people consider at PI and also elsewhere. So are there any questions about sort of the general framework before we get into the details? Okay, so we're gonna start with thermal freeze in, because it's just a little baby step away from what we were doing for freeze out. So the picture for thermal freeze in can be seen if we plot the yield, which is this number density normalized to the entropy density, as a function of 1 over the temperature or time. And the way thermal freeze out worked is that we had this equilibrium number density. And then dark matter tracked that number density up until annihilations became inefficient, and then it flattened out. Now, this part of the condition is fixed by the CMB, because the CMB tells us what y chi infinity should be. So what thermal freeze-in says is, well, if I were never following this distribution, I can draw a lot of different curves that get me to this. So for instance, I can have something that looks like this. And then I get the current dark matter abundance, but it was never in thermal equilibrium. It's completely not in thermal equilibrium. So this is sort of the freeze-in trajectory. It's a production of dark matter that just kind of gets you exactly to the right value that we see. Now, quantitatively, we say that, well, the equilibrium condition depends on the relative production and scattering rates versus the Hubble scale. So for non-thermal dark matter, we know that gamma over H is always small, right? Because if it were not small, it would come into equilibrium. This could be production, scattering, whatever you have. But just because gamma chi is small, it doesn't mean that gamma chi is zero. And so there's still some production rate, it's just slow relative to the expansion rate of the universe. So what you do is you basically start, so So this is where the initial conditions come in. You say I start with no abundance of chi, and then scatterings give y chi not equal to zero, but it's never going to be the equilibrium abundance. But because the final y chi infinity is so far below the massless thermal line, this can still work. So because you're still producing them through thermal scatterings, by thermal scatterings I mean scatterings of standard model particles in the thermal bath. So for instance, F bar goes to chi bar, and these are thermal. Because there's something that's thermal in my problem, I can use the same Boltzmann equations that I derived before. The Boltzmann equation I had before looked something like this. N chi dot plus 3h n chi equals minus sigma v n chi squared minus n chi equilibrium squared. So the fact that I'm not in equilibrium and that my number density is small relative to the equilibrium one just tells me I can cross out this term here. And so this gives me minus sigma v n chi equilibrium n chi equilibrium. And this is just what we have been calling gamma chi. It's gamma chi n chi equilibrium. Now you can say, are we cheating? Because, you know, we see some n chi equilibrium. There seems something funny about this. But remember that this term secretly came from, so this term came from chi bar goes to ff bar. This term goes ff bar to chi bar. And the only role that the actual chi number density came into play in the Boltzmann equation was in these quantum statistics factors, which we always ignored anyway. So in these chi production diagrams, we never made any assumptions about what was going on with chi. So this equation still holds as long as we cross out this term. And the only time when this term is relevant is when chi is getting close to equilibrium, in which case all of our assumptions are true. So we can actually use this full equation even for non-thermal dark matter scenarios. This is good because this is just, this should be a plus sign. So we can just take the machinery that we've developed already and solve the equation. In particular, if I define y is n over s, my equation becomes simpler. I got dy chi dt is equal to gamma chi y chi equilibrium. And this is an equation that I can just integrate. Because there's no y chi here, so I can just get 0 to infinity dt gamma chi y chi equilibrium. So this is the master Friesen formula for determining the current abundance. And it's just what we said, that there's this very gradual production of chi, and so you kind of have this, for lack of a better word, like leaking in from the visible sector into the dark sector. And as long as it produces the right abundance, that's totally fine for our purposes. Let's see if this works correctly. I think these settings are a bit funny, but whatever. Okay. So what we're interested in finding, and we'll see, is the relevant parameter. What we want is gamma over h as a function of time. And what we're going to use to measure time is T of the photon bath. Yes, Tibra.
Is there a problem of like fine tuning in this lecture?
Not necessarily. Okay, so that depends on your perspective. If I say I have this much dark matter, I need to get exactly the right abundance, then that sounds fine tuned. But of course, what's really happening is that there was some fundamental parameter which gave you a dark matter density, which we've now observed. So. Yeah, so I wouldn't say that it's necessarily fine-tuning. Just like for thermal freeze-out, we did the same thing. We said, okay, this is the abundance I want, and then what are the parameters that give it to me? The only difference was maybe that in the thermal freeze-out picture, it kind of pointed towards some large couplings, which we tend to like. This will point towards some small couplings, which we tend not to like, but there's nothing inherently fine-tuned about that. And as we'll show, the couplings are of order 10 to the minus 10. So that's small, but it's not super small. Like the Yukawa coupling is about 10 to the minus 6. So yeah, this is closer to the electron Yukawa coupling than it is to the top Yukawa coupling. So yeah, the answer is we don't understand the standard model coupling. So we don't know what's tuned or not. OK, so we're going to measure time with the temperature of the photon bath, which is fine because these dark matter particles are being produced by standard model particles that are coupled to the photon bath. So now we'll just do the same thing that we have done before. We want to estimate the rate. Okay. So by now you should all be experts at doing this. You get something that's like g to the fourth over 8 pi t squared over t squared minus m phi squared squared, where this comes from the propagator. Then I multiply by t squared to get the units right, and then there's a dependence of 4 on the coupling. And what we're assuming here is that temperature is always bigger than m chi. Of course, if temperature were much smaller than m chi, then I wouldn't have enough energy to produce m chi, and there'd be a Boltzmann suppression of its production. Okay. So gamma is just n chi equilibrium sigma v. N chi equilibrium is just t cubed. So this goes like g to the fourth t to the fifth over 8 pi times t squared minus m phi squared all squared. Now what we want to do is compare it to Hubble. Hubble goes like t squared over m Planck. So we can compute gamma over h, which is going to go like g to the fourth t cubed m Planck over t squared minus m phi squared. And I sort of just for convenience dropped some of the order one coefficients. So why do we care about gamma over h? Well, the reason is that if I'm doing this integral, I'm integrating over time, and time is 1 over Hubble. So if I assume that gamma is biggest, for say one Hubble expansion. And this is not crazy to assume, you know, gamma either gets bigger or smaller. And so there's going to be some peak gamma relative to Hubble. And so then I can just assume that this is constant, and this is approximately gamma chi over h, y chi equilibrium, evaluated at the maximum rate. Okay. This is just the usual assumption. Okay, if this is a constant, I can pull it out of the integral. If I'm integrating over short enough time, then I just get a 1 over Hubble from the time. So this is the approximate formula if there is one Hubble expansion that dominates. And as we're about to show, that turns out to be true. So if we can estimate gamma over h, then we can immediately estimate y chi at infinity. So are there any questions about the sort of general structure of FreeZen or physically what's going on? Tibor. Ah, okay. So all I'm saying, yeah, so I mean, this is a very approximate formula, but the basic idea is that if I'm doing an integral over time, and if this is at its maximum, it's not changing a lot. So if I pick a sufficiently short time, this is just equal to gamma y chi equilibrium delta t. And of course, we know that everything is changing because of the expansion of the universe. So the characteristic scale on which everything is changing is the Hubble. And Hubble is just 1 over delta t. So again, this isn't exactly correct, but it gets you something to within a factor of 2 or 3 of the right answer. So parametrically, we can study different limits and see what's going on with them and get sort of the right order of magnitude estimate. Okay. So we're now going to consider two limits of FreeZen. And these two limits are just going to be which number is bigger in the denominator, t or m phi. And that will completely dictate the behavior of FreeZen. So the first one is known as UV FreeZen. And it is set by the limit that m phi is bigger than t for all t. So this is basically the statement that this term always wins in the denominator. And so what does this mean for all t? So do you have a question? No, okay. So for all t, the universe has some reheat temperature after inflation. And this is sort of like the maximum temperature of the universe. Okay, so the Big Bang happens, inflation happens, and then the inflaton decays and gives you some thermal bath. If the temperature of that thermal bath never exceeds T reheat, but M phi is much bigger than T reheat, then we're going to be in this UV FreeZen limit. And so the limit here is simple. I just throw out the T squared term in the denominator, and I get gamma over H is just g to the fourth t cubed m Planck over m phi to the fourth. So this is for scenario one. And so we can look at this and we say, well, as the temperature gets smaller, gamma over h gets smaller. So this suggests that the maximum production rate is going to be at the very highest temperature. And this agrees with our intuition that, there's sort of one scale at which this production predominantly happens, and then it gets less important because the expansion of the universe starts winning out even more at later times. So production is dominated by what's going on at T reheat. And so y chi at infinity is basically just y chi at t reheats. And this is just y chi of equilibrium gamma t reheat. Okay. So this is y chi equilibrium times g to the fourth t cubed m Planck over m phi to the fourth. So y chi equilibrium is sort of an order one number. And so this is what we find. So if we do the usual song and dance, where we say, OK, I want it to be 25% of the critical density, yes, Tibra.
H in the second one?
Oh, yeah.
So this we have observed indirectly from the CMB. And if I write it appropriately, it's basically 4 times 10 to the minus 10 GeV over m chi. So this is the observed one. And so it's very easy to just say, OK, given a T reheat, given a G, given an m phi, you know, what's the relationship between these that gives me the observed number density? So for example, just picking some numbers, if I take m chi is 100 GeV, and T reheat is 10 to the 10 GeV, which is sort of reasonable answers for T reheat, then what I get is G over m phi is 8 times 10 to the minus 16 GeV inverse. So this tells me that either G is order 1 and m phi is really huge, it's up at the gut scale, or m phi is around T reheat and the coupling is around 10 to the minus 6. So what UV Friesen tells us is that if we have some very heavy particles, then they can produce the observed dark matter abundance through off-shell scattering in the early universe. The problem is that this is sort of unobservably small couplings, because we either have very heavy particles or pretty heavy particles and very small couplings. And the combination of them is that you get very, very small interactions in the present universe. And so this is sort of the more pessimistic Friesen scenario, because we somehow need to try and observe what's going on up at, say, the gut scale, or possibly higher. This is also relevant if chi is only coupled gravitationally. So for instance, in that case, m phi would just be m Planck. And with a sufficiently high T reheat, it could literally just be true that dark matter is produced through gravitationally coupled physics. That would be a very, very difficult scenario to study. Yes?
What is phi in that case?
It would be, say, like string modes that mediate between the dark sector and the visible sector or something like this that are 1 over m Planck suppressed. So for instance, in supersymmetry, this is often how the gravitino couples in the early universe. Yeah, it could be a quantum gravity process. So when I say couples gravitationally, I just mean there isn't any new physics up to the gravity scale. I'm being agnostic about what is going on at the gravity scale. Okay. So are there questions about UV Friesen?
So there's literally no way we can test this.
Not literally no way. And I'll talk at the end of class what maybe some ways you can test it are. Well, so to give away the punchline, the fact that we have very small couplings suggests that maybe we don't need to have a Z2 symmetry that makes dark matter stable. It could just be broken by some other very small couplings, and so you could look for evidence of decaying dark matter. That's probably the best way to study that. Alternately, if you expect new physics at the gut scale, you know, for instance, there are probes of gut scale physics through like proton decay experiments and things like this, and so maybe that could also, you might not see dark matter, but you could see some evidence for new physics at a very high scale.
So direct detection wouldn't work in this case. This is too weak.
Very, very small. I mean, direct detection or constraining couplings of order 1 and M5 order TeV. So this is like 20 orders of magnitude smaller in coupling. And so in rate, it's going to be 40 orders of magnitude smaller, which even direct detection experiments can't do. So the second one is IR Friesen. This is the opposite limit, which is that m phi is much, much smaller than t for all t. Or at least for the t's where we're calculating this rate. So in this case, gamma over H is pretty simple. It's just g to the fourth m Planck over t. And we see that this gets bigger as t goes to 0. So unlike the UV case, where you started with most of the dark matter production at a very early time, now most of the dark matter production is actually going to be happening at later times. And this is more optimistic because it means that the dominant production is going to be from low energy degrees of freedom, which maybe are at the weak scale. So the peak production is now at either t equals m phi or m chi, whichever is bigger. Because as soon as the temperature drops below either m phi or m chi, then our assumptions for driving this formula break down. In this case, gamma starts going like e to the minus m chi over t and gets smaller for lower t. If t drops below n phi, then we revert to the UV Friesen relation. Okay. Now, it turns out that if t is bigger than m phi, then we also have to have processes where phi is on shell, okay? Just like we were talking about with the LHC. So we have to consider both chi chi bar to FF bar and phi to chi chi bar. And because phi to chi chi bar goes like one power of the coupling, and FF bar to chi chi bar goes like two powers of the coupling, this wins for t bigger than m phi. So actually, gamma goes like g squared m phi, just the width of phi. H goes like t squared over m Planck, and we're going to evaluate this at t equals m phi. So if m phi is bigger than m chi, gamma over H is just g squared m Planck over m phi. So once again, I can use my formula and say, well, I want the observed dark matter number density. And so what we find is that if, say, m phi is 100, m chi is 100 GeV, m phi is about 1 TeV, g is about 10 to the minus 11. Which is certainly better than 10 to the minus 16. And you have some new states around the weak scale, so maybe we can actually see this. But what's nice about this is that there is no T reheat dependence. It only depends on the low energy parameters. Yes?
Also assume that M phi is twice the mass of the dark particle.
Larger than
twice.
Yes.
Yeah, OK, so I should say this. What I really mean is just that we can make the assumption that it's at t equals m phi, not t equals m chi, where this shuts off. But yeah, that's a good point. In the early universe, there are ways around this. So for instance, phi and chi can get thermal corrections to their mass. And so if the thermal correction to the phi mass is higher than the thermal correction to the chi mass, then you can still have decays in the early universe. Okay. So how do we look for this? So there are very few experiments that probe this level of coupling. So it's very hard to look for this. And unfortunately, all of the probes are going to be model dependent. So we don't have the same story as we did for WIMPs, where we kind of had a picture that we could draw and there were natural relationships between different rates. So the two general possibilities that people often consider is decaying dark matter. And the reason is just that we already have some very small couplings in the theory. The constraint on the coupling for decaying dark matter was that it had to be smaller than like 10 to the minus 20 or something. But if the coupling that makes dark matter decay is the square of the coupling that it is produced through, then it's not inconceivable that it's consistent. Okay. So that's sort of a generic prediction. But again, it's possible to write down thermal freeze-in models that don't have decaying dark matter. This is just the statement that, well, you know, rather than having to impose an extra symmetry to stabilize dark matter, we can try and use these small couplings to stabilize dark matter. And this is something that you're looking at on the homework, where you're just doing sort of a minor modification of indirect detection to, instead of looking for dark matter annihilation, to look for dark matter decay. And the major difference is that instead of going like rho dark matter squared, it's going to go like rho of dark matter. The second thing is basically to look for other associated states. So instead of directly looking for the dark matter, look for this phi, or maybe there are some other particles. The reason being that just because this phi has a tiny coupling to chi doesn't mean that phi has a tiny coupling to everything else. And so it might be easier to try and look for evidence for these mediators. And that at least gives you a scale that you can aim for. Now, this is mostly true for the IR freeze-in because, you know, these states might be around the weak scale and somewhere that we can actually probe them. But there are also potentially other effects associated with this phi. So for instance, maybe it violates standard model flavor. By that, I mean that in a standard model, you have these suppressed flavor-changing neutral currents. And in particular, lepton flavor is exactly conserved. So in the standard model, processes like mu decaying to E plus a photon, while allowed by electromagnetic gauge invariance, this is forbidden in the standard model. And so they're very sensitive experiments that look for these processes. And maybe if this phi couples in a way that it messes around with the standard model symmetries, then you can see it in these sorts of rare experiments. So unfortunately, with non-thermal dark matter, what you have to do is you have to write down sort of a full model and then say what are the ways of looking for it. And so for a lot of them, there are ways of looking for them, but they're, it's harder to make a case for it. Because for, say, direct detection or indirect detection, you can say, well, a whole class of models will give us this signature. Whereas looking for a particular decaying dark matter signature or a particular new resonance in your theory is going to depend a lot on the specifics of the theory. And so they're not going to build it billion-dollar machine that goes and looks for your one indirect non-thermal dark matter model, whereas they might spend not quite that much, but a lot of money on WIMP dark matter searches. Okay. So, are there questions about sort of freeze in? You know, do you understand what that means, etc.? Yes.
Then why the Big Brother
of
Shannon is at this temperature?
Why the Dahn reflection is at this temperature? So the reason is that in this, as long as this limit holds, as T gets smaller, gamma over H gets bigger. So basically what I have is something that looks like this. T, let me do it inverse T so the temperature is getting smaller. Okay. So it's getting bigger. And then you're either going to hit M phi or M chi. When I hit M phi, this approximation is no longer valid. And I have to use, where is it? I have to use this approximation. And we see that what happens is that gamma starts dropping with lower temperature. So it sort of peaks and then drops. Similarly, if I violate the T much bigger than M chi, then the rate gets an exponential separation in M chi at high temperature, or sorry, at low temperature. And so once again, I have this turnover. So I generically have this feature. And so what I do is I sort of integrate over this range. And that's what we're doing. Okay, so tomorrow we're going to move away from thermal scenarios entirely, and we're going to start talking about this misalignment production and what that means for dark matter. So, all right, see you tomorrow then.